Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
So, you know, actually, we were just talking about what we're going to do for the show tonight, but I do want to mention I want to talk about the Mandalorian most recent episode.
Okay.
Well, actually, our connections to the Mandalorian.
Okay.
We have personal connections to the Mandalorian. And no, the baby Yoda is not our child. So,
sadly. Sadly. He's really cute.
Because he would be the cutest of all of our children. He'd give Lucy a run for the money, but so let's talk about what we've been up to the last week. Earlier in the week, we still had snow on the ground. It has since melted. Sadness. We are still hopeful that we will have a white Christmas against all odds.
Right now, the grass is green.
We had a lot of rain yesterday, but earlier in the week we had snow on the ground still. And what day was it that this happened?
On Wednesday morning, okay. We woke up. So Tuesday we had rain, lots of rain. It melted all the snow that we had on the ground. And in fact, the kids were outside like pretending to fish in the puddles,
right?
Which were quite deep. Like, I think they were at least 8 inches at the deepest parts.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. It was puddle under the swings. Then on Wednesday morning, we woke up to snow. It was snowing.
The rain had turned to snow overnight.
Right. It was snowing, and it snowed pretty much all morning, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was most of the morning, and by the time it was done, there was good 3 inches on the ground.
Oh, there was about 5 to 6 inches, I'd
really?
Say. Oh, yeah. There was a lot of snow.
I didn't have to shovel any of it. The kids took care of that.
This is why you don't know, because you weren't shoveling it.
I was working. Good. That's good. Well, it seems my master plan of turning them into the snow movers is working.
Right. So I took a little trip to the library with Isabella and Lucia at lunchtime to pick up some books that we had on hold. And the sun was shining. Everything was covered with snow.
That puffy snow on the ends of the branches.
Right. We're like the picture perfect, where all the branches of every tree are covered with snow and it's just gleaming white in the sun.
Against the blue sky, the winter blue sky. Yeah.
It was so beautiful. I said, you know what? We should just skip our afternoon lessons and go for a hike. And they were like, okay. So I went home.
They were like, whatever.
I went home and I proposed this to the other kids and everyone was like, okay. So we did. We played hooky from school.
So you guys got all bundled up.
Yes. Everyone was wearing snow pants and hats and coats and gloves.
Boots and yep. Everything.
Boots.
And you didn't go far. You went because Holbrook, it's the town we live in, Holbrook, has a wonderful little town forest.
Yeah, you know, we didn't really know where it was or anything about it for the first few years we lived here, and honestly, taking small children into the forest was not high on my agenda.
Look,
when
kids,
they were all small.
A house made of candy. What are the odds?
But now they're all old enough, and so in the past year or so, we've discovered our little town forest.
Partly through scouts. I mean,
right.
the town forest committee is mostly people involved in scouting, and we do a lot of scouting activities in the town forest. We have the big difference was when they showed us where you park to get access.
Right. This was the thing is I frequently drove past a trailhead that said town forest, but it's on a busy street and there's no clear place to park, like especially not a big van like ours. Like if I tried to park on the street,
you'd be partially blocking a major thoroughfare.
I'd be blocking traffic. So this was not a street that had like edge of the road parking on it.
Right.
Or it's not a street where any of the residents park on the street. And so I was like, how do people access this? Because there's this trailhead and I see online that people go to visit the town forest. Where are they parking?
Well,
it was a mystery.
Obviously, You park on Park Road, because that's literally the name of this street that's off of the main street. It's actually two turns off of a main street.
Well, my favorite is that you turn onto Forest Street, and then you turn onto Park Road, and you park on Park Road off of Forest Street.
In front of a bunch of houses, which apparently they are aware of.
Right. Like, you're parking, like, literally as if you're visiting somebody's house. Like, you're parking on the street in front of their house.
It's a dead-end street, and beyond the dead-end is where the trail begins into the woods.
Right. And if you didn't know it was there...
You would never stumble across it
because, like, from the trail, from like the parking area, you can't see the trailhead and the markers. So, like, there's nothing to tell you this is the town forest parking spot.
I think I might suggest that to the folks, that maybe they need a sign or something over
there.
It's
going to be like somebody's, you know, a scout project. Oh,
maybe we have a future Eagle Scout project.
Anyway, it's a very nice little forest with very well marked out trails.
Yep.
They're all very well blazed. There's a blue trail and a red trail.
Thank you to Adam.
Trail. Yeah.
He's one of the scout leaders who I know has done that.
So we went. Now we know how to get around. We parked. We were the only people there in the town forest.
I should clarify, this was without me. I was at home working. So it was just you and the kids.
So it was like maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon when we got over there.
So you had about a half hour of sunlight left.
Right. Yeah. I think we had about an hour of sunlight. We walked about a mile all round trip. So we just sort of walked up the trail and back. It was gorgeous. Like the walking in the woods in the snow, crunch of the snow under your boots. Everything is covered with snow. And the late afternoon winter sunlight is coming through the trees at this sharp angle.
The pictures that you took, and I think I might try to use one of those pictures for the cover art for this episode if it fits. But the pictures you took were beautiful.
Now the juxtaposition, the irony is, I'm enjoying my beautiful walk through the peaceful, magical Narnia woods, meanwhile all the kids are running ahead of me, and they're playing some sort of soldier game where some of the kids will run ahead of the others. And then hide in the trees.
Set up an ambush.
And set an ambush. And then the kids will come follow along. And then they'll, like, get into a gunfight. They found sticks. Of course they found sticks. We're in the forest. And they were shooting at each other basically the whole time there and back.
So you're like Lucy in Narnia. And they're like...
Right. And I'm, like, stumbling over
they're
dead...
At Valley Forge.
Oh, dead bodies. Yeah. Like, strewn across the trail that I'm having to step over. Like, children pretending to be dead. you look dead. Do you need a medic? No, I think you're too far gone. Oh, well. I kept trying to point out, like, ooh, look at that tree. Ooh, look at the light there. Isn't that beautiful? Bella kind of, for a while, was trying to look for birds. She'd brought her binoculars, but she wasn't having any luck finding birds. I think the other kids were scaring them away.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She kind of looked at the light, and she oohed and aahed with me for a little bit, and then she got caught up with wanting to play the soldier game. She put away the binoculars, and she was... fighting battles with the rest of them.
So in the end, it was a good hike.
It was a good hike. By the end, of course, everyone was tired and getting hungry. And Lucy was a little bit overwhelmed, both by hunger and by the fact that her legs are half as long as everybody else's.
Right. Or a quarter in your case.
But, you know, it was a good hike.
Yeah.
It was a very good call. And awesome. Yeah, it was nice.
Well, so that was Wednesday. On Thursday was December 12th. It was the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And we decided to celebrate in true Texan style. We went out for Mexican food.
Yes.
we went to this great restaurant nearby called Sombreros, where it's not even just that the food is good, which it is. Here's something you need to know about Mexican food in the Boston area. When you go on online to, like, Yelp and look at reviews, there's always two things that are noted on every review: how the guacamole is and how the margaritas are, or the margs, if you want to use the local.
I'm cringing.
It's very cringy. No mention of the actual food. But
you can never find reviews of the enchiladas or the.
No, because there are a bunch of Yankees who don't know any better. But we've been to this one a few times, and it's really good, run by I think they're Mexican, but they might be Guatemalan. I'm not sure. Yeah, but it's a family, and they're so welcoming to us. So, you know, we come in, we're the seven, the family is seven. We all come trooping in, and they're so welcoming to us, so friendly to us, so accommodating, especially since, because Lucy can't frankly eat almost anything in the restaurant. We bring our own tortillas that she can eat, the cassava tortillas. And I mean, we were tempted to bring also her refried beans that she can eat.
Yeah, she also brought a package of
chips,
potato chips.
Because, right, for the salsa.
Because while there are some like alternative
non-corn
tortilla chips, what she really likes with salsa is
potato chips. You know,
Cape Cod brand.
You
like,
can't blame her.
Potato chips.
You know, with everything she has, you know, you can't blame her. So we end up bringing, but they're so accommodating, so nice. They put a couple tables together for us. The decorations is, you have to note. So that's very nice. One of the things that the theme we see around most places is tequila production, agave growing, and then tequila production. They have these plates that are painted. Except at our table, I think the plate that you originally hung over, it must have got broken because there was a plate hanging that wasn't like the others. And this one had painted on it like an Aztec sacrifice. Mm-hmm. It was like an Aztec priest dragging a woman onto an altar. I'm like,
I'd like
some human sacrifice with your tortillas.
It's like, what is that a picture of? And we kind of looked at it and went,
they're playing a game. Actually, I think we just said it's Aztec human sacrifice. We don't get into the prurient details, but we just,
they've studied history. It's in the history books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was funny. But the food is always awesome. It was really good. And like I had a chimichanga because, you know, I'm sorry. I just got to have it. Like I can have you can have a burrito or you could deep fry the burrito.
I do not understand the appeal. I have
No. You, I don't think you heard me. It's deep fried.
Yeah, you lost me.
So I had that and you had fajitas that you shared with Lucy.
Yes.
And then Ben had chicken fingers and Sophie and Anthony, they both got the same thing. They had a quesadilla.
No, Sophie had a burrito.
Oh, a burrito. And
Anthony had.
Yeah, I think he had a quesadilla.
No,
they didn't have quesadillas. Anyway, whatever it was they had. The one thing I'm proud of is that they all the kids' meals get a choice of French fries or rice and beans. They all chose rice and beans. That goes to you. That shows good upbringing.
Yes.
So
only proper.
Yes, that was very nice. So sombreros is always nice. I mean, like seriously though, from a Texan point of view, from a Texan review for Mexican food in Massachusetts.
For Mexican food in Massachusetts, it's pretty good. Yeah. I probably wouldn't eat there in Austin, but
you wouldn't hold a candle to Arandas or to any of the other places.
Or Chewy's or Chewy's. All
yeah.
places.
Fun of San Miguel is a whole nother league.
Right.
I mean, that's I'm on board with that. I mean, I love all those places in Austin. Okay. So that was Thursday. It was really nice. And then let's skip ahead because I don't think it's anything really notable. The other Friday or Saturday.
Well, Friday was Santa Lucia Day.
Oh my gosh! How did I forget? I didn't put it in my notes. Friday was the feast of Santa Lucia. So the tradition is we wake up and we listen to Andrea Bocelli singing Santa Lucia. I'm almost saying Santa Maria. Santa Lucia.
Okay, so a lot of people's tradition involves having special buns for breakfast.
Right.
We've managed, I think, special things for breakfast maybe once. Most of the time, I don't make them the day before because I'm too busy. So we ended up having dessert.
Right. So you made a Lucia bread.
Right. I make like a sweet, well, it's not like a really sweet bread. It's like a challah bread.
It's a slightly sweeter challah that you then glaze.
But yeah, I add some like lemon zest and orange zest to kind of give it a little bit of like extra
festive
flavor, and I think a pinch of nutmeg, and then add a little bit of extra sweetness, and then I glazed it with cream cheese frosting.
No, ironically, Lucy can't eat it because it's made with flour.
But I started making this before she was born. And before she was diagnosed with allergies, like I had already started making this. And so the other kids expect it. It's a tradition. So then I end up making two desserts for Santa Lucia Day.
And so the one you made for her is with like Lucia buns, essentially.
Right. They're closer to the Swedish tradition of Lucia buns, which are like a saffron bun shaped like an S. I didn't actually have any saffron this year because there was a container of saffron on the shelf in the pantry that turned out to be empty.
Yeah, I'm a little dubious about that. In fact, I have to put that on the shopping list.
So basically, I just made her. Well, I didn't find a recipe that I liked, so I faked it.
Fake it till you make it. Fake it when you bake it.
So she basically, they were like some almond flour, some coconut flour, some tapioca flour, some rice flour. I pretty much just cleared out my gluten-free flour stash and threw it in with some butter, some milk and eggs and sugar and some spices. I put cinnamon and clove and nutmeg. We made kind of like little spicy buns. They were okay. They were not the best. They were not the worst. Lucy was happy.
But they would have been better if they were almond flour.
They would have been better if they were all almond flour, or mostly almond flour, more almond flour. I didn't have very much of it. I think I could have added some maybe almond butter or regular butter. Like, I don't know if they were fatty enough.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Is December is celebration month. You get St. Nicholas, you get Our Lady of Guadalupe, you get Santa Lucia, and of course, you get Christmas. You know, coming up. I mean, there's so much going on. So many different opportunities to celebrate. It's really
and the kids are like, it's just like the month of good eating.
It starts with Thanksgiving and goes all the way through.
Yeah.
So, and I'm looking forward to Christmas Eve. And then so that was Friday. Saturday, I had to work. Jimmy Aiken and I recorded three podcasts for Mysterious World. And you were a whirlwind.
Yeah, I did lots of catching up on house cleaning that doesn't happen most of the time.
Getting ready for Christmas. I
told the kids today, I really have one thing that I want for Christmas, which is I want to have a clean house. So here's the thing. It's sort of an adage among homeschool moms that you can have a clean house, well-educated kids, or good food to eat. Maybe pick two, but all three is just not going to happen.
Right.
So where I usually end up skimping is, frankly, housekeeping.
And the more kids there are, the less likely it is to even have two of those.
I used to be a much better housekeeper. I mean, I've never been a great housekeeper, but I used to be a better housekeeper than I am now when we had fewer kids.
That is a truer words. I think people completely understand that. It's where, like I've said it before, seven people living in a 1,400 square foot, generous 1,400 square foot house. You know, I mean, it's hard to without a garage or a basement or an attic. You know,
right. We don't have any storage. And honestly, there's probably quite a few years of stuff where I wasn't doing any decluttering, purging, throwing things away that we don't need. And so like there's backlogs of stuff that just kind of got shoved into corners here and there that needs to be gone through. And like, I'm the only one who can do it.
There are a few corners of our house where if we cleared out the stuff there, we would be shocked at how much more room it feels like, how bigger this house feels. I see that. Yeah. I mean, we're doing what we can. It'll get better over time, especially as Sophie it gets a little older. So we should tell the story of the harsh but effective Lord Cromwell.
Oh, we really should. This is such a great story. This is my favorite thing in the past few weeks is anytime I ask the kids to start to clean up, like at the end of the day, our living room is our playroom as well as our family room. And it gets very messy, like carpet of Legos on the floor, plus all the other stuff. So at the end of the day, we try to do a cleanup to reset the room, at least somewhat to a somewhat livable
to clean the center and maybe an edge or two.
Right. Yeah. And oftentimes it really is like we're cleaning the middle part of the room and the edges don't always get close attention. But anyway, when I ask the kids to clean up, they've over the years have invented various games to, you know, make the work kind of fun. But with more or less effectiveness. One of their favorite ones is pretending to be small, furry animals like raccoons and squirrels. And I give them a treat for every so many things that they clean up. But this one is one they've come up with on their own. And it involves, evidently, Sophia being...
putting on a cloak.
Putting on a black cloak. And it's like a role-playing game, like so many of their games. And she is Lord Cromwell.
Lord Cromwell, not Lady Cromwell.
No, Lord Cromwell.
Yeah.
Who is a cruel...
Taskmaster.
Taskmaster. And all the other kids are servants in his household, evidently, except some of them are evidently like foreign princes in disguise.
Might be foreign princes in disguise.
I think Ben is a French prince in disguise. But in any case, Sophie sort of stands in the middle of the room with the black cloak on, sneering at them and barking orders at them. Do you call that clean? Look at that horrible mess.
And they cheerfully clean it up. If I did that, they would be in tears.
Right.
I have to tell you, I came out of the office when this game first starting, and I went in like, Sophie, you're being really mean to them. You need to stop. And she's like, no, we're just playing a game. I'm like, what? You can't talk to them like this. No, it's fine. We're having fun. Right.
And they were all fine with it. And I had the same reaction. I was appalled. Like, what is all this yelling? You're being really mean.
She's yelling at them. I can't imagine what people would think if they saw this, came in and saw this. And we stand back like, hey, it's getting clean.
She's remarkably effective, even though she's not herself picking up anything. Somehow the other four more than make up for it.
And they work.
But I think part of it is that they often need somebody to sort of be the expediter to notice the things and be the one to kind of, you do this, you do that. And I try to do that, but I'm often, doing other things.
You're trying to make dinner and other stuff. Yeah, you and I are usually, trying to do multiple things at once while we're also trying to expedite. But she stands there and she knows where things go and she tells them what to do with it. And it is hysterical. It is so funny. And yet it's just so.
Right. She has clearly emerged as the child who, she keeps the girls' room clean pretty much single-handed. If it was up to Isabella and Lucia, the room would be a mess most of the time.
She's the leader. I mean, she really is.
Yeah.
Bella is the visionary leader. She's the one who has the ideas,
But
like, Sophie is the one who affects things. She gets things done.
She's managerial.
She's the CEO. Yeah, so... yeah, it is an interesting hierarchy going on in there. I mean, they even clean the boys' room.
Right. Sometimes I'll say, the living room looks pretty clean, but do you guys think you could do a nice thing for your brothers and like help them with their room, which is pretty messy? And so Sophia's like, okay, we can do that. And so she goes and is Lord Cromwell in the boys' room. And
she kind of enjoys cleaning. She likes
Right, she likes it when things get clean and organized. And she likes being the bad guy. Like in all of their games, she's usually
the villain.
She's usually, Darth Vader or Kylo Ren or
Lord Cromwell.
Or Lord Cromwell.
And yet she's such a pleasant girl. She's
very sweet.
She's so funny and she laughs so much.
She laughs at your jokes.
She laughs at all my jokes, all my dad jokes. I love her the best. She's always smiling. Other people notice this, by the way, about her, is that she's always smiling. And the harder she's working, the more she's smiling. That's when someone said to me with Scouts, I think it was Heather said she's noticed her at the Klondike last year, that the whole time, especially when they're doing like a hard thing, like carrying the sled or something like that, Sophie's smiling. She's just so smiling.
Yeah, she's got this great dimply smile, like huge smile. I don't know. Yeah. It's funny.
So then today we went, we had mass this morning. We'll talk about that in a second. And then this afternoon we went to get our Christmas tree where it's the third Sunday of Advent. It's Gaudete Sunday. So that's about when we usually get our tree.
Yeah. Some years later, some years a little bit. Well, usually not earlier.
Well, especially given how, again, the Sundays move around a bit. We talked about that before. So we went to get our tree at our usual place, which is Home Depot. Some people would sneer at that sort of thing. But you know what? The trees we get at Home Depot last. We keep our tree up pretty, like at least to the baptism of the Lord. So almost a month.
Right. You know, I 1 year when you were not capable of, I don't even remember why you didn't come and get the tree with us. I tried Christmas tree a lot and that tree was definitely not.
I didn't go with you 1 year. That's weird. I don't remember that. But we used to get them at Lots. We got 1 year. We got it from Boy Scouts over in Randolph. I know that.
Yeah, I don't think they do that anymore, do they?
No, I haven't seen it. This, a lot of Scouts don't do that stuff anymore. But
I would buy it from the Scouts if they were.
If the Scouts were doing it, I would buy it too. But but there are Lots around. But I don't know that they're much better. They're often more expensive. I mean,
they do actually seem more expensive. Like I thought Home Depot would be more expensive.
But no, they buy in bulk.
I guess so.
I mean, our tree. And so here's the thing. If I had my druthers, if I had all the space I could, I would want a big, honking, obnoxious, you know, Christmas vacation Chevy Chase tree. I would, you know, fill the room, go to the cathedral ceiling. That's that. I would love that.
And for me, I mean, I wouldn't object to a big tree, but given the small space.
Right.
I kind of
my lean, eyes are often bigger than our living room.
I lean towards the embrace the small space, go with it like a cute little Charlie Brown tree. It doesn't matter if it's got some scraggles because it's going to get so covered with ornaments. You're not going to be able to see the tree anyway.
Well, there's Charlie Brown trees and then there's Charlie Brown trees. Like I'm OK with a tree that's got a bald spot here, like a gap here and there. I don't like trees with the massive spaces in them. I like a somewhat full tree. But again, given the space we have, one of these trees, the tree we got was about, 6 feet tall?
It was a compromise tree.
Yeah. Well,
it was bigger than I would have wanted. Like, I would have liked the
You would
the
have
first
even
one.
Smaller?
I would have liked the one that Ben picked up.
That was
up
like 3 feet tall.
Yeah, it was cute.
No.
See?
Our children would be taller than that.
Yeah.
No. That is... Come on. It's like, I mean, okay, it is a compromise tree. I thought it was giving in to your wish, but you really wanted that tiny tree?
Yes. I would have, if that had been me and the kids and your opinion had not been at all there, I would have got the first
God,
tree
I
that
went.
Ben grabbed. It was cute. It was kind of scraggly.
But you put the thing in a car seat that was tiny.
It was not that much smaller than the one we bought.
It would have been like the tree in Charlie Brown's Christmas. You shake it, all the needles fall to the ground.
It was like a foot shorter.
You put like one bulb on it and it bends over.
See, we have very different ideas about Christmas trees.
We do. It's like a lot of things. So I guess we got a compromise tree.
I
did not realize it, but yes, we did. So we got the tree and we got a new stand because the old stand we had for a while. It's big. It's too big. It's for a big tree.
Yeah.
And we
don't have a big tree.
We don't have a big
tree. We've established.
I mean, in the past, I've cranked the bolts all the way down and it barely touches the tree. You know what I mean? So we had to get a new stand. We got some new lights because every year we have to get new lights because for some reason the lights die every summer in the bin. I don't know what it is, but they're dying in there. So we got some new lights.
The mice.
Probably. Or the heat. In the shed, because that's, again, we have no storage, so it goes in the shed. So we got some lights with I think that was about it. And then then all the silly decorations that we got at in the Home Depot and all that stuff.
I feel like looking at them, I don't want to actually buy any of them.
But. Yeah, yeah. The giant penguin. Bella wanted the giant penguin.
She did want the giant penguin.
The giant inflatable penguin. So we got the tree, brought it home. And trimming it a little more than the guy, the kid who was more interested in jabbering with his coworker than actually taking care of the tree.
Yeah, you get better luck with the older guys.
The old guys know what they're doing. They take pride in their work.
They do.
But yeah, so I had to retrim some of the branches so we can get it in the stand. But you did some more cleaning. My mom came over.
Yeah, we did not actually decorate the tree today. That's for tomorrow.
Well, you can't decorate the same day you bring it in the house. No. You gotta let the branches.
Yeah. So yeah, I cleaned up the part of the living room where the tree was going to go. I put away lots of stuff. Like we said, the margins of the room often don't get thoroughly cleaned by the kids.
The room is very clean now.
It involves putting a lot of puzzle boxes together and moving books and throwing away trash. Lots of paper airplanes went to their last final resting place today.
The Wright-Patterson Air Force Base of paper airplanes.
Yeah. And... And like books being reshelved, and it And the vacuum cleaner came out an awful lot. There was a lot of stuff to be vacuumed.
Yeah. Yeah. Once I got rid of the air mattress that your sister broke.
I sadly said goodbye to the air mattress.
Melanie's parents had purchased an air mattress to keep here for when they came to visit. They could. We don't have an extra room, so they sleep on that. But on her last night here, Melanie's sister was turning it on. It's not really her fault. It ingested a bit of yarn and it burned the motor out. So,
except in as much that the yarn was her fault because she was
knitting. Her yarn.
It was actually our yarn that she was knitting.
Okay. Nevertheless, it burned it out. So we had to toss it up, unfortunately. But luckily we have a second one that we got for free, which is a whole nother story. But we got the room clean, mostly. It's in much better shape than it was. Like much better shape.
Yes. I told the kids, though, that tomorrow we're going to do part two of the living room clean out.
Yes.
And attack some of the other corners that need some TLC.
Right. Right. And we have to say that Bella has been doing the bulk of the decorating.
She has been. She's at that age where she's really loving the process of decorating and taking pride in being the one to decorate. I remember being the same way at her age, and it's really nice. It's sweet.
So,
and she's good at it.
Yes. So as I mentioned, we had gone to Mass this morning, of course, and we had a visiting priest there. He's a Jesuit who's from Africa. We're not sure what country. I think he's probably Nigeria.
He didn't say, but
he sounded a lot like Father Michael, who is from Nigeria. So
if I had to guess, I would guess it's probably Nigeria.
And he's a doctoral student at Boston College, of course, because, you know, Jesuits, you know, there are a lot of them at Boston College getting their doctorates. And
since it is a Jesuit college.
Right. And so he was there for Mass, filling in, and as you would expect. So there's different kinds of Jesuits. There's like the American Jesuits, which is kind of the stereotype that you expect. But African Jesuits are cut from a different cloth. They are still solid, by and large. I mean, I'm sure that they're good ones and bad ones here and there, whatever. But so this one, he got what you expect from a Jesuit priest. Preaching on the third Sunday of Advent, Gaudete Sunday, which he hit every reading.
He started with talking about the entrance antiphon and the collect, and he went on through the first reading, the psalm, the second reading, the gospel, tied them all together in a very beautiful package, brought out a lot of great points. It was really nice, very well constructed and well delivered.
Yeah.
It was pleasant.
So the key line I got from it was, he said, do not spend your time thinking about what you're getting for Christmas. Do not spend your time worrying about what you're going to get for Christmas presents.
Right.
Spend your time wondering what you're going to get from Christmas. Get out of Christmas.
Yes. I liked that.
Yeah. That was a nice formulation.
And, he spent a lot of time talking about joy.
Mm-hmm.
Which appropriate for the day, and it was a very nice.
He celebrated reverently, very reverently, very. You could tell he has a sense of for the liturgy. He's got a strong aesthetic sense for the liturgy.
Yeah, and it was
his singing of the doxology.
Beautiful, beautiful.
So
voice.
He did a cappella, you know, through him, with him, in him. That part in our church, which. Is this big English Gothic church,
and neo-Gothic,
but yeah, fine lines. Thank you for that. Which it echoed so well. And he has such a nice voice, and it just beautifully echoed unaccompanied. And I'm like, oh, I don't think I've ever heard someone sing so, like, the singing affect me so much in that church, because it was not really amplified. There's a microphone up there, but it wasn't the cantor's microphone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was really nice. And then at the end of Mass, he walked over to the Advent wreath and was talking about, again, the third Sunday of Advent. And he wanted to make a point about, you know, the pink candle. And so he goes to lift the pink candle out of the Advent wreath up there. And he kind of has to struggle a bit. And I'm probably like all the other guys out there, like the dads, the guys who have been around the block once or twice, who saw that and said, oh, don't do that. Because if it's that hard to get it out, you're not going to be able to get it back in again. Sure enough, he's like trying to get it back. And he's like, oh. And he's like tilting it and it's lit. And I'm like waiting for all the wax to come out of it. And he's trying to get it. I don't know where he finally stuck it, but it wasn't where it started. So hopefully Father Michael got it back later. But that was pretty funny. So really nice mass. Really good. You know, it's such a shame. It's such a beautiful church. And it's such an early mass. And there's just so few people there.
At 8 a.m., it's...
It's hard to expect people to get in there. But still, it's just... I really wish more people were there, could appreciate the beauty of... I mean, the mass is beautiful, set on the hood of a Jeep. You know, but it's the beauty of this particular church that's devoted to St. Edith Stein. I mean, just... It's hard to... It's a shame. But it's a beautiful mass. So I'm really glad about that. And, of course, the kids, Bella and Benedict, served at mass again, which was really good to see that happening on a regular basis. And we got there early this time. Last time we were late, but they got there early this time.
Yes.
So let's,
there's nothing like being late to like one Sunday to kind of spur on the getting ready a little bit faster.
Get out of the house on time this morning. Yeah, it was good.
This is Dom Bettinelli, CEO of SQPN, with a special message. The StarQuest Network is fulfilling its mission to explore the intersection of faith and pop culture, and in the past year we've reached stunning new heights. Our programs are reaching broad new audiences with a message that helps us discern good entertainment, make sense of the world, and share the gospel with others. We continue to launch new shows and bring back great shows. We just relaunched Secrets of Star Wars, which comes at the perfect moment to capture the excitement over the new show, The Mandalorian, and the climax of the new Star Wars movies. The support of our audience is vital to this work and has helped us grow closer to meeting our financial obligations. For that, we are very grateful. But we still need to close the gap. Every new gift extends our deadline, but until we eliminate our deficits, the future of StarQuest and your favorite shows remain in question. This is why it's crucial we hear from you this Advent and Christmas, the time when nonprofits receive most of their support for the year. If you're already a supporter of StarQuest, we are very grateful and we ask you to prayerfully consider increasing your support at this time. If you are not yet a supporter, please become one now. We urgently need your help and every gift counts. Could you give $15 or even just $10 per month? That lets us provide more than 40 hours of professionally produced shows with compelling content. We have special thank you gifts for donors at several giving levels. If you are a business owner or just want to provide a leadership level of support, we now have a special giving level for sponsors, like in public broadcasting. For $500 per month, you or your business can sponsor one of the shows on our network. Listeners will hear a message in every episode thanking you for your sponsorship and giving your website. We'll also have your name and link on the SQPN webpage and in the show notes of every episode during your sponsorship. Whatever level of support you can offer, whether large or small, please show your support for SQPN this Christmas, and remember that your gifts are tax deductible. Just go to SQPN.com/give. That's SQPN.com/give. And may God bless you and yours as we approach the celebration of our Lord's birth.
So we talked a little about going to Sombreros for the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. We really didn't have a whole lot of very interesting meals otherwise, like unusual. We had one that you made, which was a soup that you made, a chicken soup that was made, you know, leftover. We had some leftover chicken that you doctored up.
Yeah,
with an unusual
I've been feeling like I'm making the same soups over and over again, and I'm getting tired of them. So I had leftover chicken and I didn't have a whole lot of it. So not enough to make enchiladas or anything with it. So I was like, okay, soup it is. I can throw in a can of beans and that'll add some extra protein. So I'm looking through the pantry saying, what can I do to make this soup more interesting? And I found a couple cans of Hatch enchilada sauce, which I don't know if you know Hatch chili peppers, but they're from New Mexico.
They're specific to New Mexico.
Yes, they're only grown in New Mexico, to the best of my knowledge. And anyway, so I made chicken soup with two cans of Hatch chili sauce.
Enchilada sauce
thrown into it. And it was okay.
It wasn't great.
If I'd had some other stuff to throw in the soup, it would have been better. Like, there was just not a lot of vegetables, so it was kind of a thin soup.
Well, you know, the other thing I was thinking afterward was, if it had more lime juice.
Lime would have been good.
Yeah, we need a more vinegar, more you know, a vinegary or acid. That's what I mean.
More acid.
Yeah, more acid would have been. I think it would have made it a little better soup.
Yeah,
a little tastier.
For a weeknight, I don't know what the heck I'm doing.
It was soup. It was good.
It was pretty good.
Yeah, and you were able to then, you know, kind of before you put the hatch stuff in, you segregated out a bunch, threw in some leftover egg noodles, and made chicken noodle soup for Bella, who doesn't like. You know, soup with
like
tomatoes,
spice,
and all the other stuff. So that worked out okay.
Yeah, it was not bad.
It's the struggle that we're having, and you kind of touched on a little bit this grind of the we're stuck in this wheel. This, you know, this, what do you call it, the rodent wheel of hamster wheel?
The hamster wheel of death.
Of food, where we're making the same dishes over and over again because this is what the kids will eat. We'll have pasta and sauce, we'll have rice bowls, we'll have,
because there's only a small handful of things that all the kids like.
Yes.
And so then the other nights you're like, well, I'll make something that 3 out of the 4-5 kids like, but then the other, I have to figure out what to feed the other 2 kids that they'll eat.
Right.
I know some families have a policy, and it's not a bad one, that this is what dinner is, everybody eats it. I'm not a short order cook, I'm not going to make other things. One, we have a child with a lot of food allergies. 2, we like a lot of really spicy foods. And so we decided early on, when we just had 1 child, that we were not going to expect our children to eat really spicy curry, but neither were we going to deprive ourselves of our favorite spicy dishes so that we could all eat the same meal together.
Right. Which then put us on the path of, we then have to make multiple things.
Right. And but it was a conscious decision. I mean, I sort of looked at the options and said, well, this is the best of the lot. Like, I would rather make multiple things, but I'm not going to expect small children to like really spicy food. Like, I will hope that eventually they will come to like it, and most of them have. But I don't think it's fair to do this is what we're having for dinner, you must eat it when,
right,
when
we,
it's,
we did the whole no thank you bite thing for a while when they were little,
but not for the spicy stuff.
Right. But even for stuff like that, they just ew, I don't want it. Like, we did that when they were smaller, but now, I mean, you just, there's only so much you can fight over it.
And you know, once kids get to a certain age, their tastes are more or less set.
But this problem gets worse in the winter, because in the summer, There's a lot more grilling. We grill 3 or 4 times a night. I mean, every week. I mean, we and that gives us more options. It opens up, because they love anything that's been cooked over fire. You know, it becomes a lot easier.
And it's easier for me because I can then focus on like making sides while you're outside grilling the meat,
yeah,
the main dish.
Yeah. And so the winter comes around, and so we're stuck in this wheel of these 6 dishes that we seem to keep making. And I want to make other things. And so one of the reasons we bring it up is I'd like to hear what other people do. You know, what do you do? You know, what are your policies with your family and how you choose what meals you make, and if the kids don't eat it, or do you just all eat whatever? You don't really care what you eat. You know, you're not really picky about it. I'm kind of curious what other families do, but I think I want to get back to deciding like, okay, we're going to make 2 dishes. I'm going to make this 1 dish that you and I are going to eat, and maybe 2 others. And then we'll have this backup that's easier that they'll eat. And not every night, but occasionally, because I want to make, there's things I like when we're doing meal planning for the week. And I'm pulling out the Paprika cookbook app, and I'm looking at, these are all these recipes I want to try. And you're like, nope, no one will eat that. No one will eat that. No one likes that. Like, I want to try it. You know, so I think we're going to have to do that. Well, as Melanie looks dubious. Although it kind of worked tonight. You made curry. Chicken curry.
I mean, chicken curry, which is, you know, definitely not a favorite for everybody.
Right. And there were 2 who...
Although it's Sophie's favorite. Sophie loves curry.
Right.
In fact, I think it goes back to when she was like not even a year old. She was she had a mild food allergies or food sensitivities. She couldn't eat dairy for a while, and while we were trying to figure it out, she was on like a very, very basic, bland bananas, rice, toast diet.
Right.
And then one night I had curry and she was sitting on my lap and she was like begging for the food. And I was like, okay, fine. I'll give you a bite. We'll watch you like shriek in pain. And then that will be the end of that. And you won't be begging for food off my plate anymore, except
she loved it.
She adored it. She ate so much of it. And that's pretty much like ever since then, it's been a love affair with curry for her. She loves curry.
Anthony was something similar where he was little and was when Tree was living with us. And was Tree living with us with Anthony?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah. Cause, and then we had Thai curry and we gave him some and he was like, yum, and wanted more. So, yeah, he was one who liked it. Bella, I remember what put Bella off was homemade pizza, and you would make some with just cheese and sauce and some with jalapenos, pickled jalapenos for us. And she got one of the pickled jalapeno ones by mistake and burned her mouth. She was like two at most. And that's when she said, tasty, tasty, which meant hot. I don't want to eat it. And that, I think from that point on, she wouldn't take anything that had any bit of spice to it.
Right. She's actually become a little bit more adventuresome. She will now sometimes dip a corner of a tortilla chip into salsa, like a little tiny corner. But, you know, yeah. She's trying. And I think she's starting to like it better.
And even Ben will occasionally eat a hot wing. When I get hot wings.
Right. He does like hot wings.
Yeah.
Which is surprising. He's always been pretty averse to spice.
Yep. But so. I think he sees how much other people enjoy it. And there's a social element in that.
Right. I firmly believe in the social element. But I also do think that, like, you can't just necessarily, like, what do you call it? You can't just make somebody stop being picky by, like, refusing to.
Right.
To feed them.
Right.
I know.
So we.
I know people think that they can, but yeah. I think that they haven't had a truly picky child.
To close the loop, you talked to Bella and Ben before dinner, saying we're having curry tonight. What do you want to have that we can make now instead of waiting to sit at the table and then have them go, ooh, I don't want this, and then have to deal at the table with they're staring at food, they're hungry, and now they have to go make something.
Right. I have a hard time multitasking this. And so being proactive and saying like, it's another thing to think about when I'm trying to make dinner and I'm feeling rushed and tired and not really wanting to cook at all.
But we were able to get that. And you had her make the mac and cheese for her and Ben, and you had to help a bit. We've also got a, we realize that we've got to get Bella and Sophie cooking. They're at the stage where they should be doing more cooking than they are. They need to learn how to do some cooking. But you got her to make it. You led her through the steps. And so it was ready that when we sat down to eat, their food was ready to eat. And I think that made dinner go a lot better. I think we both agreed that, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, whew.
Now, will we remember this lesson next time? Probably not.
Let's hope. So let's talk about some of the stuff we've been enjoying, reading or watching. You've been watching some new things this week, right?
I don't know. Some new things.
Or a new thing. Segway.
Right. Now it's completely gone out of my head.
Victoria?
Yes, I've been watching the latest. I noticed recently that a new season of Victoria had dropped on Amazon Prime. And so I've been watching that. It's a fun series. It's got
Jenna Coleman
from
very cute Jenna Coleman
from Doctor Who. She makes a very cute Victoria. And I don't remember the actor's name who plays.
Well, he's the guy from Man in the High Castle, who was the Nazi. And oh, what was his name? Oh, somebody out there is yelling it and I'm trying to telepathically receive it. And I will remember it in a second after I.
Anyway, he's a really sweet Prince Albert. I like him a lot.
Which is so different from.
I mean, but they make him not I like the fact that neither Victoria nor Albert is 100% sympathetic. Like, they both have moments when you're just like, I'm not really liking you right now.
Albert. No. So I was thinking of the other guy, because I haven't watched it. I just know he's in it. But Albert is played by this guy, Tom Hughes.
Let me see here.
This guy.
Yeah, he's got a really nice German accent. He's probably not actually German, but he does a nice accent.
He went to Upton High School before whatever. He's born in Cheshire. He's a Cheshire cat.
Okay.
But yes.
This week had some the episode I watched had some conflict between Victoria and Albert on how to best teach little Bertie, who doesn't like school and doesn't like learning. And Victoria thinks that Albert is being a little bit of a bully, and Albert thinks that she's being too soft. And so it was a nice, you know, a realistic picture of family life.
Mm.
What I don't like about this show as much, though, it seems to be de rigueur in British historical dramas, is that they spend a lot of time with the, like, servants, the people who work for Victoria and Alice. Victoria and Albert in the palace downstairs, and like these like subplots about the cook and the dresser and the various servants. And I don't know, I feel like it distracts from what I would rather spend time with. But that's just kind of me. I don't know. I guess it's because we can't spend all this time with the fabulously wealthy noble class without also paying attention to the poor underclass who serves them. There's a point to it. I get it. It's just not really my taste.
So the actor I was trying to think of was Rufus Sewell, who played Lord Melbourne.
Lord Melbourne is her prime minister when she first becomes queen. But in the second season, maybe.
Spoilers.
It's even the beginning of the first season. He goes off on his own way. He doesn't last forever.
He disappears. So, okay. So. Thumbs up. I haven't seen any of that, so that's although I have wanted to, because, you know, it's interesting. The two big series right now about queens of England are starring Jenna Coleman from Doctor Who and The Crown. Oh, what is her name? I had it right there. I'm really terrible with the names. The Crown, and it's from the David Tennant series where they were Broadchurch, and her name is right there, Olivia Colman.
Oh, see, I haven't seen that. She was not Queen Elizabeth in the first two seasons of The Crown. So I haven't seen Olivia Colman season.
And of course, the husband in before that was Matt Smith.
Right. that was fun. The Matt Smith is Prince Philip.
Prince Philip. Yeah, we actually joke all the time on the Secrets of Doctor Who. That there's like 8 actors in England. They just show up in everything.
Sometimes it kind of feels like it.
It's the same small pool of actors.
It's a small island.
Yes, it is a small. I mean, it's only so big. So, yeah, cool. And then you said you've been reading a new book.
Yeah, I've been reading 2 new books, but I'll just talk about one because I don't want to like completely monopolize the conversation.
Like I did last week.
Right. So I'm bouncing back and forth. Like every other night, I'm reading one of these 2 massive tomes that are both 500 pages. One of them is called The Warmth of Other Suns. It's a nonfiction. It's a history book. It's about the Great Migration, which is something I had never learned about in school. And I had never even heard about really until the past couple of years. But the Great Migration happens between roughly World War I through the 60s, and it is a massive migration of African Americans from the South to the North and the West. Escaping the horrible Jim Crow laws and seeking, you know, economic prosperity and opportunities. And it's this book is really fascinating. So it follows basically 3 characters.
Real people.
3 real people. So it's or sort of based on oral history. She did interviews with these 3 people. And then in between, she kind of fills in sort of the bigger picture and anecdotes from other people, like smaller bits and pieces. But essentially, it follows one man who immigrates to California from Louisiana in the
1953.
in the 50s. He's a surgeon whose parents were both, his father was a principal and his mom was a school teacher. He served in the army and
eventually became personal physician to Barack Obama.
Did he? Oh,
I'm reading the blurb on the
That's further than I've got in the book. Spoilers!
Ooh, sorry.
anyway, so he's a really interesting character. Like when he gets to California, he assumes that things are going to be easy and they're not. I'm halfway through the book, but I'm only sort of getting to the point where the people are actually leaving the South, because the first part of the book is sort of the background, like their lives before they leave.
Hmm.
And then there's a woman who is from, I want to say
she is from Mississippi,
who goes to Milwaukee.
Yes.
And then there's a man who moves from Florida to New York.
Harlem, specifically.
Specifically to Harlem. Yeah. He's just arrived in Harlem, where I am in the book. It's a really, really well-written book. Like, it is very captivating. It's very hard to put down at the end of the day. I want to keep reading until, like, 2 o'clock in the morning. This is...
It's won, like, a billion awards.
Yeah. And rightly so. Like, she I think she won the Pulitzer.
She's won the Pulitzer. Came out in 2011.
Right. So it's not a super recent book, but it's fairly recent.
Fairly recent. Yeah.
And,
So 6 million people moved... migrated between 1915 and 1970, 6 million. Right. That is one of the epic migrations in history.
Right. It is one of the biggest migrations in history, and we did not learn about it in school.
Right.
And it's fascinating to me. Now, one of the
I always wondered about that, though. You know, like because the slavery was in the South, and you had all these black people who live in the North now, and I always assumed it was, well, after the Civil War, they left the South because, you know, they didn't want to live there anymore. But apparently not. Not so simple.
Right. It's and she goes into a lot more about the Jim Crow laws and the situation in the South after Reconstruction failed,
right,
essentially, than I had known about. I mean, I sort of knew bits and pieces, but like seeing a big picture, like all across the South, it was really horrifying.
Hmm.
I have to say, I thought I knew how bad it was, and I don't think I really did.
Right. Even as someone who grew up in the South.
Which
Texas sort of qualifies as.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, you get a little bit of that as the doctor drives through Texas to get to California, and there is no place for him to stop.
Mm.
There are no hotels
that accommodate black people.
That accommodate. One of the interesting things, actually, about the book is she uses throughout each time period the words that people would use. So at his time, it's colored people.
Right.
And it shifts throughout the book as using the language that they would have used for themselves and other people would have used, like the common language. It's really one of the interesting things that adds like a sort of texture to the book. I almost like just.
Does faith play much of a role in the story?
Not really. I mean, there's some going to church. There's some kind of talk about it, but it doesn't seem to be a major factor in the lives of the individuals.
Or at least in what she's reporting.
Right. And yeah, it's hard to know. Like, is she just not very interested in that aspect of their lives, or is it not very important to them in particular?
Because, I would love to hear what role faith had played in, not just in causing them to move, but just the role of faith in their lives as they migrated. Because faith, for lots of people who've migrated, whether it was the Irish or the Italians, faith was a huge element in bringing your faith with you and practicing your faith.
I mean, she kind
of
talks about that. Like one of the things that she says is that, right, just as Italian Americans tended to, like, people from one town in Italy would tend to move to one city in the U.S. because one person would sort of go and establish a beachhead and then other people would follow. But the same thing happened in the Great Migration. So... There are very clear patterns where people from this particular state would move to this particular place up north. People from this town would move to that town. And so you would have communities of people from, like, you know, this town in Louisiana, Monroe, Louisiana, and they would all move to this particular place in, I can't remember the names.
In California?
Me. Yeah. Right. There are a whole bunch of them in California. And so then people would, you know, get together on like Sundays when they didn't have to work, and Saturday nights, of course, that became sort of a big thing too.
Right.
And they would, you know, share stories from back home, and they shared, you know, culture and food. And it was very much like there would be little pockets of like, and they would have clubs and churches that were basically sort of the same way that you would have Italian American churches in Boston. You
and
would
the Sons have, of Italy Club.
And the Sons of Italy Club. Yeah. You would have like a Texas club or a Louisiana club or an Alabama club in Chicago.
Hmm.
So where people from those places could go and find other people from their home state and talk about back home, because as bad as it was still home, and you still had family left behind and you missed it. Like, there were things about it you didn't miss, of course. They didn't want to go back.
But it's interesting. There's actually some elements of that even now. But the identity is often in sports. So, like, if you go to, like, Los Angeles, there's a Steelers bar, and there'll be a Patriots bar, and there'll be, like, a Red Sox bar. Like, you know, where people gather, people from back home gather together to watch the games together. There's that self-identity of the expatriates, shall we say, you know, the people who've left.
Well, and in some ways, really, during before the Civil Rights Movement, during the Jim Crow time, they were almost two countries, especially for African Americans. Like, it talked about how one of the train lines would have colored cars in the South, and then they hit a certain point, and at the station they would take those cars off, and then they would put integrated cars on the train.
In fact, very interesting, because there's a book I read last year about the history of camping in America, like going camping,
right?
Which there's a history, and it's fascinating, actually. I love the book, but one of the things it talks about was how federal law required federal lands to be integrated. But what happens when those federal lands are in the South, like in Virginia and the Shenandoah? And these issues came up of the people from that area wanted the segregated, like, you drive into the national park and it would be not segregated. And then you're trying to, but, you know, you don't always know where the borders are. And you drive over here and now it's the state park that's inside the national park, you know, the state forest. And now it is segregated. Like, it's sort of like two countries.
Right. And it very much one of the things is this book pointed out is that even where things were integrated, when people moved from the South, they often didn't know where the line was, or they mm-hmm. even when they knew, it was still such a culture shock that and even when they were in the North, where it was technically not segregated, there were a lot of people who ignored that, who
right.
you know, we're sorry, we're full up for the night, we don't have a place for you to stay, even though
right.
technically, the laws didn't support that. Unfortunately, the culture.
Yes, there was still racism was rampant.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a really, really interesting social history of
fascinating.
Of a long era in history. That even though the people themselves at the time didn't think of themselves as being part of a great anything or a movement or a migration.
They were just moving.
Right. My life is bad here. I've got a cousin there. I'm going there. My life will be better. They don't see themselves as part of a pattern or a movement. And yet, it clearly was. And
frankly, in 50 years, there may be a new movement that people have identified even that today based on other factors. So it's you don't always know it when you're in it.
Right. And that's one of the interesting things is sort of that
interesting
view of history.
Cool. So I'll quickly just mention a couple of things that I've been watching. So I've been watching Babylon 5. I know it's really weird that I never saw Babylon 5. I think I mentioned before I was in Ohio at school where I didn't have cable when Babylon 5 was out, and I never could see it. So it was just not something I could watch, just like X-Files at the time. And so it's something I've come to now that it's on Amazon Prime. I can watch it, and it's fun. It's kind of fun to go back and watch what was once groundbreaking and amazing computer generated special effects. And I'm going, I have better video games than this now. So it's fun. But the storytelling is really good. I know that.
Yeah, I never saw it either. So
it's really complex storytelling. I mean, just like at the level of like when people were talking about how Lost had a complex story that it was telling, Babylon 5 was doing that. So I'm really interested in getting into that. And then in somewhat related, I'm actually watching the fourth season of The Expanse, which is based on the best-selling series of books, which I love, which I mentioned a few weeks ago. And this is the fourth season that was The Expanse for the first few seasons was on the Sci-Fi Channel, got canceled, and the fans all rose up and demanded that Netflix or Amazon or somebody pick this up and keep making it, and they did. Amazon did. And so there's a fourth season. It looks great. Really fabulous. And it's the most accurate physics in a science fiction show right now. They really try to get the physics accurate. I mean, it's future physics. I mean, it's future technology. So they speculate out a bit, but it's still based on, like, you've got to decelerate in space. You've got to accelerate in space.
Right. I like science fiction that takes into account the laws of physics.
Yeah. It's hard sci-fi, but it's not really like it's accessible hard sci-fi. So really enjoying that. I'm only a few episodes in, so standard disclaimers apply. There'll be something in the next episode that I haven't watched yet that is completely offensive and no one should ever watch it. But that disclaimer is that so far it's really good. So
you always give that disclaimer.
I have to give that disclaimer because it happens.
It always happens.
It always happens. So, all right. So we should probably wrap it up there. That we've been going for about an hour, and that's a good length of time to talk. Do want to take a moment, very important, to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Charles K., Dr. T., Craig H., Adam C., and Kenneth L. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So what did you think of anything we had to say? We'd love to hear your feedback. Tell us about your family, how your family deals with meals and that sort of thing, or anything interesting that you've been reading or watching. We'd love to hear from you. You can comment at sqpn.com/bets or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or you can send an email to bets, that's BETTS, at sqpn.com. And we'll have links to the books and the other things that we mentioned in the show notes at sqpn.com/bets. If you have not done so, if you're listening to this off a website or someone sent you a file, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts and Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, our SQPN YouTube channel. You can even, if you have an Amazon Echo, you can just say the wake word. I won't say it now. It'll wake it up. But Echo, play Raising the Bets on StarQuest. Actually, I would say play Raising the Bets podcast. That would do it. I'm pretty sure. I'll have to test that out to make sure, but it works for like Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and other things. I've tested it with those. I haven't tested it with our podcast, but that's the way it's supposed to work. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.